garden. I'm all alone, and I'm stuck with this geek with a leg brace, this strange, sickly mama's boy who can't run, who's got this drippy nose and this weird hair, who spent a summer in an iron lung, which made him as frightening to me as the mummy. Not to mention that his mother's a goy in a neighborhood with 13 synagogues in 8 square blocks. Robbie had begun solemnly, but by now he'd taken on some of the brightness that inevitably reflected from him as he told his stories. So for a good 6 months solid, I was ragging on Morty and slapping him around, and one day I give him a belt as usual for the pure pleasure of watching him cry. And something in his eyes, it came through like a rocket. This is the moment of my life. I said to myself almost out loud, Morty feels just as bad as I do. I'm 6, 7 years old now, so I mean this is basically E equals MC squared for somebody at that age. And I don't know, that young, you have to say it was only a feeling. But I knew then, everybody's got this, what I felt, this hurt. Everybody has it somewhere in their heart. And I knew that I'd never really get away from it, and neither would anyone else. And life bears that out, doesn't it? It's being poor, or being alone, or being sick. It's not being loved enough, or not loving the way you want to. It's feeling you're the doormat to the world, or a mean crud, or just not quite as good as the people you want to be like or be with. But it's always something, and it's devouring for most people, this parasite always eating a hole in their hearts. And I wondered, why? Why did God make a world where everybody's heart is in pain? And hanging with Morty, looking at him, you know what I figured out? The answer. I mean, I think I did. You know why it's like that? So we need each other. So we don't just each take our guitars and go off one by one to the jungle and eat the breadfruit that falls off the trees. It's so we stick with each other, do for each other, and build up the world. Because misery does love company, and another soul's comfort is the only balm for the wounds. And how would you say it? How do they put it in the Bible? The shadow of God came over him. I looked at Mort and knew all of that. And Mort knew that too. And from then on we just sort of held on to each other for dear life. She did not know exactly what this meant now, and neither did he. Perhaps he was saying again that he forgave Mort, or was explaining why he would have to. Or perhaps he was telling her that Mort had violated the fundamental assumptions of their relationship. He twirled the chicken's wishbone in his fingers and considered it in the kitchen's nuclear glow, resuming his silence. Talking to McManus, she'd volunteered to stand guard over Robbie again tonight. There were several agents who'd be arriving shortly to cover the house, but this, after all, had been her assignment to start, to keep an eye on Favor. Right now she had no other place to stay anyway. There were reporters encamped in the lobby of her building, hoping to get a look at Secret Special Agent Evan Miller. Elba called down that Rainey's eyes had opened and Robbie was gone for quite some time. Rainey had seen something about him on TV during the day. He was going to tell her the story, he said, in about 3 sentences, and skip prison. She was too weak to summon much by now, even occasionally too weary to wear the laser contraption that looked like a miner's light, which she'd been using to control the computer and the voice device. While he was gone, Evan settled herself again in the spare room on the second floor. It was done up with elaborate yellow frills on the window treatments and the coverlet, a day room of kinds. She still could not accommodate herself to this life where money was spent just to be spending money. Looking for a pillowcase, she wandered into the would-be nursery for Nancy Taylor Rosenberg next to the Favors' bedroom. A sofa bed was made up. Both Elba and Robbie took spells sleeping in here, while the other was looking over Rainey, massaging, applying lotion, checking the oxygen and the color of her fingernails. Through the wall she could hear the clanking from the cuirass as it finished its cycle of compression. Over it, intermittently, Robbie's voice was audible, cresting in the plaintive timbre of some disagreement. The speech synthesizer carried clearly through the plaster, but Rainey lacked the energy to employ it very often. Even, however, heard one phrase that sent a shock straight to the marrow. "You promised," the robot declared. Robbie emerged a few minutes later as Even was going back down the corridor, and he motioned her once more into the nursery. He was blowing his nose. "She wants to talk to you later. Now that she knows you're FBI, she thinks you'll make me keep my word." He smiled faintly, but she felt a pulse, colder and more desperate, of what had traveled through her a moment before. She and Robbie had never spoken about this. Rainey must have just told him that she confided in her. Discovered in unexpected possession of a secret so intimate, Even felt a brief impulse to double over in shame. She said softly, "You don't have to do that, Robbie." "Yes, I do. I can't say I was lying. Not this time. They promised if she took it a day at a time, she'd always be in control. You'd do it too, Even, if you'd promised, if it was someone you loved." Would she? The horror of the prospect sank through her. It was easy to say no, never. She'd learned right from wrong in church and in school. But those lessons took the living as healthy, hopeful creatures, not the poor, suffering soul who lay next door already most of the way to passing. The doctor visited every day now. He had told Robbie that he'd had one ALS patient who'd chosen ventilation at the ultimate moment and remained alive for several more years. For days, Robbie had awaited that change of heart, but Rainey had seemingly made the other choice. As a trapped moth beats its wings, she breathed now with famished urgency, requiring too much effort to allow normal slumber. The deprivation of oxygen and sleep would soon produce a hallucinatory state. While some clarity remained, Rainey was determined to go. "Tomorrow," he said. "Maybe Saturday. There are a few people she has to see. I don't know what to do about Morty and Joan right now, and I want to get past this fucking grand jury thing." Senate had called the first session of the Petros grand jury for the next day. Robbie raked his fingers back through his hair and took a seat on the sofa bed. "It's not like you're thinking, anyway. It's just letting nature take its course." "I'm not judging, Robbie. Nobody has that right." He accepted the reassurance, but as ever, he talked. The doctor and he had tiptoed around this subject pretty carefully, he said. There were vials of leftover sleeping pills lined up on the bookshelf near her bed. Just a normal dose, the same amount she'd been taking a month ago, would be enough to plunge her into a slumber that would persist when he disconnected the cuirass. That was all. She would go on her own, in 10 to 20 minutes, in peace. He was entirely still, imagining the event, the reality of being there with her at the moment she went from the present to the past. He took as much of it as he could stand. Then his mind, predictably, jumped. "So what exactly did you girls do that day when you were alone?" She was vague. "Read," she said. "Talked sometimes." "About?" "You too," she said. "Love?" "Yeah, love," he answered and shook his head over the largeness of life. Then he angled his face in curiosity. "What about you?" he asked. "Ever been in love? Along the way? Like I told you about Rainey? You know, boom. She's right. She fits. She gets me and I get her." "You mean do lesbians fall in love?" He reared back. "Fine, you don't want to talk about it.
Fine.
She suffered herself a second, then apologized, battling back the reflex not to answer him, or herself. Had she been in love? Tina Creant, if that had happened, might have been love. But it hadn't, and she wasn't going to pretend. No, she told him. She couldn't say she'd been in love.
That's too bad, he answered.
You missed a lot of fun. He gave her a level look. There isn't a bonus round, you know. To soften that, he took her hand for a second. Then he seemed to come back to his own troubles.
Jesus, he said. Talk about the week from hell.
He keeled over on the sofa bed and lay immobile a second, his arms thrown wide.
So would it, like, violate the FBI code of honor if I ask you to sit here for a little while I sleep?
Nope. I mean, hey, she said. He did not bother undressing or pulling the coverlet back. She went down and got a magazine to read by the hall light. His eyes popped open when she returned.
So can I say I slept with you now?
She reached over to bat his foot with the copy of People.
Straight up, he said. Have you ever thought about that?
What?
Sleeping with me.
Good Lord, she shot her eyes toward the wall behind which his wife lay dying.
I mean, I understand that I'm not the main attraction, he said, and I'm not even hinting about anything real. But I just wondered if, just for a second,
people think a lot of things for just a second, Robbie. Most of the world's inside your head, right? But that's not my play.
No, I know,
he told her quickly. He was pleased, nonetheless. She looked at him with the feeling of something as large as a monument moving within her.
How in the world could you ever explain this?
They said some sculptors often saw form, beauty, in the flaws within stone.
Go to sleep, she said.
He did. His mouth at moments moved involuntarily like a baby's, smacking his lips. Once the silence settled in, she felt something returning that she'd shunted away. Then Pandora's trunk swung wide open and she heard him again. No bonus round. She crept down the hall to one of the bathrooms, needing to contend with that in privacy. She knew. Oh, she knew. There were moments when she felt she would melt with sheer yearning. But she didn't want what some other people settled for, what Merrill had with her husband, a love inseparable from the riches the world showered on him, or even what Rainey had put up with, loved, but as a captive, humiliated and paralyzed long before her body had deserted her. She needed something better than either woman had, so she just had to hope, like so many other people in the world who went to bed each night and prayed, God, God, please send me love. She prayed. It was probably going to be a woman, almost for certain. She'd gotten herself that far. But today, examining herself in a mirror again under harsh light, she believed for the first time in her life that she'd actually recognize love and be willing to accept it when it came along. She'd missed her chances in the past, she knew that. But she believed, oh, truly believed as you did when the feeling of the holy entered your heart. She believed she was ready. She turned on a faucet and briefly bathed her face, then let her eyes rise so she could see herself as she dared even to think it. She was someone else. Chapter 45. When our law school friend Clifton Baring was prosecuted for the bribe he'd accepted in that hotel room, Stan not only withdrew from Clifton's case, but appeared as a witness in his behalf at his sentencing. It was a dramatic gesture, fond and forgiving, and I always admired Stan for it. But it also burnished the patina on his statue.
It was important to Stan, the racially sensitive Republican, to be seen as Clifton's friend. The same, I realized, could not be said about me. Sennett was sitting on the hood of my car when I got back to the garage under the Lesueur after my meeting with Stern. As I subsequently learned, agents had been looking out for me. When one of them had noticed me trudging down Marshall Avenue, Sennett had been called, and he'd relieved the G-man who'd been staked out on my BMW. There was another agent at the door to my office, and a third waiting a discreet distance down the block from my home. I greeted Stan by telling him to get off the car. He didn't move. "I want the tape," he said. I had spent quite a bit of time by myself in Stern's club, sorting things out. It's said that a lawyer who litigates against a friend is likely to end up one friend short. I'd always known that, and I'd never had illusions about Stan's nature when he was on the job. As had once been joked at the bar show, Stan was the true Hobbesian man, nasty, brutish, and short. I didn't mind that he'd kept Mort's secret. He was obliged to, having promised him complete confidentiality. And he'd warned me from the start that Robbie was lying, and was thus at his own peril for saying that Mort knew nothing of the payoffs. All of that was rightfully as it should have been. But I knew our friendship was over, nevertheless. I clicked the remote to open my car. At this hour, close to 9 p.m., the garage was nearly empty. The light was murky from the naked 60-watt bulbs hanging intermittently from porcelain collars in the concrete abutments overhead. The air was unpleasant, with exhaust fumes and the lingering smoke of the tobacco exiles who snuck down here on break. "Don't pretend you don't know what I'm talking about, George. It's grand jury day tomorrow, remember? Everybody's been served. And when Robbie gets in there, I'm asking the jackpot question. Where's the tape? And don't think I won't land on him with both feet if he perjures himself." Moving toward the car door, I told Stan I was sick of his threats. "It's not a threat, George. I'm advising you of consequences. There's a difference." "I had a consequence or two of my own to acquaint him with," I said. "Raise the issue of that tape before the grand jury, and I'd go straight to the chief judge, Moira Winchell, with a motion to suppress." He sneered. "You can't make a suppression motion in front of a grand jury." But he was wrong about that. There's a single exception in federal law in the case of an unlawful electronic interception of private communications. "There was nothing illegal about making that tape." "No?" I asked. "Show me the consent form. Show me where Robbie provided the authorization the government needed before it could overhear his conversation with Brendan Toohey." There was surely no warrant, as there had been with Skolnick. It was always an odd moment when I outsmarted Stan Sennett. It happened rarely, but he appeared so flummoxed and defenseless at those instants, it was hard not to feel sorry for him. But not tonight. Tonight I had a good time watching him sputter. "It's implied. His consent is implied. He turned on the car." "Only for heat," I answered. "He had a deal and a duty to cooperate, George. Given all the circumstances, Moira's going to find his consent was implicit." "I wasn't worried about that anymore," I told him. "No court would ever find that Robbie's consent was fully informed, or that he had any further duties under his deal. Not after the U.S. attorney had engaged in attempted homicide."
"Homicide?"
"Attempted manslaughter, at least," I said. "He had sent Robbie out to the public forest believing to a moral certainty that someone was going to kill him on Brendan Toohey's behalf." Something in Sennett went into retreat. Seated on the hood, he became a narrow, smallish man, unable to still a faint, nervous flaring of his nostrils.
"He was completely covered! The surveillance, the protective detail couldn't have been tighter. And he knew he was at risk, George. He knew what he was getting himself into."
"On the contrary," I answered. "The setting was frightening. But as McManus had explained, logic
based on what the rest of us knew, said Tui and Kosik wouldn't share secrets with Robbie at Attitude, only to kill him a week and a half later. But watching Rollo on Monday when Robbie displayed the subpoena Even had served, Stan had finally accepted that Favor was not going to get close to Tui again. And so he'd decided he would have to nab Brendan another way. On Tuesday, he'd sent Mort to betray Robbie to Brendan, carrying a message calculated to lead Tui to but one conclusion. They had to kill Favor before he started to talk. And Brendan obliged Stan. Sitting at the table, Tui had tied a noose. And then Stan let Robbie go to the forest to make sure the government had an ironclad case for conspiracy to murder a federal witness. He might as well have painted a target on Robbie's back. And Stan had told no one of any of that. Not because of need to know or his promise to Dinnerstein or any similarly flimsy rationale for manipulation. He'd kept silent because he realized that if anyone else understood his plan, it could falter. Robbie almost certainly wouldn't have gone out there, nor would McManus have let him.
"I made judgments," said Stan, "on the fly, under pressure. I see how you're looking at this, George, but these are evil people, truly evil. They have messed with this city far too long."
In many respects, I still regard Stan Sennett as a great man, a great public man. He believed in the right things, and if improving the world is the measure of a human's ultimate worth, he will forever be deemed a better person than I am. His commitment to vanquish wrong and restore justice was as powerful as Superman's. Yet military strategists will tell you about replication, an inviolate principle which says that organizations which oppose each other tend over time to become alike. In that light, it was no surprise that fighting evil, as Stan put it, tempted him to evil. But if self-respect couldn't restrain his crudest appetites, his zeal and his ambition when they led him into darkness, why, I asked, didn't he at least feel some obligation to me? It was a sad conclusion after a couple of decades to find he lacked even a minimal desire to preserve our friendship, especially when it might have preserved his decency as well.
"Georgie, for God's sake, don't be histrionic. We've had a tough day, you and I. We've had them before. Life will go on."
"No," I said. "No."
Still on the hood, Stan pondered me over his shoulder in the grimy light. A floor above, tires squealed on the rubberized paint applied to the ramps.
"Revenge, George. Personal spite. That's not a good reason to let someone like Brendan Tui walk away. It isn't, and you know it isn't. What do either one of you get out of that, you or your client?"
I had always yielded to Stan. That was our history. Not that I ever sold a client short or failed to challenge Senate's positions in court. Yet I'd long let all the matters resolve on the basis that he held the high ground of moral conviction. I swam, as defense lawyers do, in the brackish waters of compromise. I'd decided to represent Robbie Favor to find out if there were absolutes I could cling to with the same tenacity as Stan, hoping that would provide me some comfort. And it did, at the moment. I told Stan that whether or not he got that tape had nothing to do with me. Were it my call, I'd probably throw it in the River Kindle. But the decision was Robbie Favor's. "You'll have to ask him for it," I said. "You'll have to ask him, knowing he's got every legal right to say it should never see the light of day. You'll have to appeal to him, Stan. Maybe beg him. And I'm glad that's going to happen, because it will remind you of something you've completely forgotten, what it feels like to be at another person's mercy." I got in and started the engine. He scooted off the hood quickly enough to reflect some concern I might damn well drive away with him still on it. I'm not sure Stan had ever been frightened of me before. Needless to mention,
The moment provided me with no small measure of satisfaction. Chapter 46. The grand jury room was situated in the new federal building, a floor above the United States Attorney's office. The chief judge, whose ostensible duty it was to restrain prosecutorial abuse, was a block away across Federal Square, in the grand old courthouse to which the district court judges all returned once the new building proved nearly uninhabitable. Built in Augie Boccaro's heyday, with subcontracts sprinkled down among his henchmen like sugar from a baker's hands, the new building had heat and air conditioning systems that were eternally on the blink. The windows, until each one was replaced, frequently popped out in high winds, terrifying pedestrians on several blocks. For years it was commonplace to find a herd of attorneys standing 20 or 30 abreast in half a dozen federal courtrooms, bickering about one of the pieces of complex litigation the new construction had spawned. The grand jury room's reception area looked as if it might be attached to a homeless shelter or a cheap motel. The low-grade plasterboard was marred and gouged, and the likes of the foam furniture, soft forms without armrests or separate cushions, had not been seen since the height of the 60s. The pieces had apparently been discovered in the recesses of some government warehouse and offered to various federal agencies at a price they couldn't refuse in the former Reagan era of suffocating budgetary restraint. Looking at the furnishings, you could just about imagine hippies in beads dropping acid and holding onto their headbands. Instead, for more than a decade, the witnesses awaiting their appearances had perched there, dejectedly hunched like molting birds. Today there was an extraordinary assemblage. As always, Senate had acted with cunning and subpoenaed everyone whom Robbie had recorded to any effect at all. Several obscure court clerks and deputies were here, as well as persons far more prominent. Sherm Crowthers sat like a lump of stone beside his lawyer, Jackson Ayers, a skillful and obstinate government foe whose analysis of any case, much like Sherman's, reliably started and ended with race. Jackson had brought a colleague, a cat's paw, to represent the ravaged-looking Judith McQueevy, who by now had recanted her confession of 2 evenings before. There were 13 or 14 persons subpoenaed in all, and some obvious absences, Pincus Leibovic and Kwan, and most notably Barnett Skolnick, all of whom by now had folded and turned. Everyone else who stood in peril of indictment was present, even Walter Wunsch, whose pancreatic cancer left him unlikely to live until even the speediest trial. The point of this exercise was relatively clear to me and not particularly pretty. To force an appearance, each of the prospective defendants had been served with a subpoena duces tecum, demanding the production of documents or physical objects in their personal possession. Date books seemed to be the chief item required, although two of the clerks had been summoned to bring merchandise Robbie had presented as tips. Gretchen Suvalek, Jillian Sullivan's clerk, clutched a Tiffany box containing a set of earrings Robbie had provided for general ingratiation. Walter Wunsch, seated with his attorney, Mel Tooley, who represented a number of those present, had brought not only various court volumes, but also the set of expensive graphite-shafted irons which Robbie had presented to him several weeks ago. Walter held the clubs, complete with a snappy black leather carry bag, against his knee, manifesting a state of glum agitation which made it look as if he'd discovered only after arriving here that he had not been invited to play. Following Robbie's testimony, each person would be called before the grand jury by a Senate or one of the phalanx of assistant U.S. attorneys assisting him. And after various legal gymnastics aimed at skirting the Fifth Amendment, forced to surrender what they'd brought. This exercise, however, would be largely pageantry. Stan had other motives in dragging his targets down here. He wanted them to confront favor,
to see for themselves that his cooperation was not simply half-baked media speculation. He wanted them to face each other, familiar figures, silent conspirators, now brought low. Yet even this was ancillary to Stan's principal purpose. The morning papers had announced that the Petrus grand jury was convening today, a result, no doubt, of one of Senate's well-timed leaks. TV crews were downstairs, just outside the building's doors, and print reporters were stalking the hallways. They could not attend the grand jury sessions, which were secret by law, but they would report who had come and gone from the courthouse. As a result, each of the persons who could not find a comfortable spot on the uncomfortable furniture would be vilified by the end of the day. Still shots and video clips of them would appear in all the media organs. It was no less than a naked march through the streets, during which their presumptive criminality would be displayed like waffles and belly fat to the amusement or horror of every person they knew. That was Senate's real aim. To crush them, to deal the first of many hard blows to be borne as the cost of refusing to cooperate, and to show them that most of the esteem they'd held in the eyes of others was already gone. Looking around the room, seeing everyone else similarly devastated, they would know that sooner or later one of them, probably many more, would do the only sensible thing: capitulate, snitch, do time, and move on. Most of these persons didn't know me. When I emerged after escorting Robbie to the attorney witness room down the hall where Even and McManus were now keeping him company, only one or two of the future defendants cast spiteful looks in my direction. Sherm Crowthers, who sat clutching his sister's hand, clearly wished me dead. But the enmity that I felt broil me like microwaves came from another source: the lawyers. As the persons charged with protecting their clients from just the kind of savaging Senate had delivered, the attorneys here, Tooley, Ned Halsey, Jackson Ayers, several others, were in a nasty mood. Tooley came to pal around first. With his silly toupee, like the coat of a shaggy poodle, and his tight continental tailoring ill-suited to his hogshead physique, Mel was a vision of disingenuousness.
"I'd like to talk to your guy. Down the road, you know. Possible?"
"Unlikely."
"Will you get me the answer to a question or two?"
That was more in the realm.
"I'll call you," said Mel. "You know," he said, turning back, "the one with the titanium testicles is you. Your guy got squeezed, but nobody was forcing you to help him, George. I hope I don't have the co-defendant the next time you're in state court."
It was advocacy of a kind, the underhanded variety in which Mel specialized. He was suggesting I'd better quickly disassociate myself from the prosecution and help out the defendants if I wanted my practice to survive. I had already turned heel without comment when, at the stroke of 10, Stan appeared. He was tight as a bowstring and in the happy clutch of the intense precision that sustained him. It had not all worked out as he hoped, but it was still a bright moment for him. He stood among the despised as the man who had vanquished them. He said good morning only to the grand jury clerk. Then, as he reached the door of the grand jury room, he faced me. "Give me a second," he said, "to tell the jurors what this is all about."
"I'll tell them," yelled Walter Wunsch. He was closest to the door. "I'll tell them plenty. American citizens, I fought for this goddamn country, and now it's like Red China with spooks and bugs. Let me in there."
Walter had risen to his feet, a somewhat pathetic exercise because he was already wasting. His flesh hung just enough to leave the impression that in the degenerative processes of the cancer, his skin was attempting to slough itself from the muscle and bone. Tooley advanced from my side and made his client sit down.
"He's just telling it like it is," said Sherm Crowthers wearily from across the room.
Stan took this in with an indulgent smile. At other moments he would have hated the disorder, but now he knew he'd caused it. He suggested I get Robbie ready. I returned to the small attorney witness room down one of the interior corridors. The space was often used for coffee breaks and quick lunches by the court reporter and the clerk. Arriving earlier, I'd nearly reeled from the driving odor of the white onions arising from a half-eaten sandwich that had remained overnight in the drab metal trash bin. Although I'd removed the can, the odor was still strong. Except for questions about the tape, Robbie's testimony was predictable. Once he entered the small, windowless room where the 23 grand jurors waited like the audience in a small theater, a desultory exercise would take place. He would identify his initials on the dozens of reel-to-reel tapes and computer magazines and say, "Yes, that's accurate," when Evans 302s describing various critical events were read to him. When that was over, come what may, Robbie could not change his account of what had happened without risking a conviction for perjury. There was even some chance this would be the last time he testified. Understandably, Stan had never wanted to stake his prosecutions on Robbie's credibility, and he'd constructed the evidence, especially the recordings, so he could prove his cases without putting favor on the stand. If he called him at all, it would only be as a show of open-handedness for the juries. We had brought Robbie in through the back corridor and secreted him in the witness room, but there was only one door to the grand jury room. As Stan had planned it, Robbie would have to run a gauntlet of more than a dozen persons who felt their trust in him had been primitively violated. But the notion that they were all out there seemed to amuse him. "Curtain call," he said. His mood was somewhat dislocated. He was clearly too exhausted to be going through this today, but because of his refusal to surrender the tape, I had no ability to appeal to Senate. At that point, Moses knocked and beckoned us. "Ready?" I asked. Favor wanted 1 second and motioned for Evan to follow him the other way down the corridor. "When Stan asks me for that tape," he said to her, "if I tell him to go scratch, where does that leave me with you?" The cassette was in my briefcase, but I still had no idea what Robbie would do. I didn't expect Stan to try to coerce Robbie into surrendering the tape before the grand jury, because I had the upper hand on the law. If Senate forced me to go to Chief Judge Winchell, he stood a good chance of losing the right ever to use the tape against Toohey. Instead, I anticipated a personal appeal at some point, an apology to Robbie, and a request he give up the tape and sign a form acknowledging somewhat fictitiously that he'd consented to the recording. I thought in the end it would come down to whom Robbie hated more, Brendan or Stan, although shame was also a factor. In a way, the tape memorialized Mort's betrayal. In arriving at a decision, however, Robbie was worried about something else. "If you feel like I'm screwing you over by not letting him have it," he told Evan, "then I'll give it to him." She weaseled at first, said it was his decision, not hers, but he wouldn't let her off that way. "You know me," she said. "It's black and white. That's why I have such a damn hard time with myself. Two wrongs don't make a right. That's where I come out, personally. But I'll stand up for you either way, bub. You tell him to go spit, I'm right here behind you." She stiffened her chin and nodded. Her only hesitation was McManus. She cared about what he would say, the same way Robbie cared about her, and she told Favor that. They returned to the conference room, and Robbie put the same question to Jim. Would he feel personally messed over if Senate didn't get the tape? Would he feel like he'd wasted his time? Jim adjusted the large frames on his nose. His demeanor betrayed some of the intense calculation going on within, but his tone was placid. "I think we did a lot of good work here. I'll always be proud of it. I'd like to get to Toohey. He's a bad guy. But I've lived 22 years on this job, convinced that the government comes out the loser if you get a bad guy a bad way. So I'll handle whatever you decide. Personally, I'd say take some time. Sort it out." Favor nodded and looked at the three of us.
I can't give it to him, he said. Not today.
We all lingered there, perhaps waiting to see if hearing him say it changed anything, but it didn't seem to. Even was as good as her word and patted his arm.
Showtime, Robbie said then, and opened the door himself.
I think I'll come along just to keep you company, said Even, just to make sure nobody gets disorderly. Robbie reminded her that there were metal detectors at the entrance of the courthouse. The firearms and switchblades had presumably been left behind. But he seemed content to go forward with his honor guard, Even leading and Jim covering him from behind and me at his shoulder. Robbie emerged from the shadowed corridor with his eyes fast and his stride certain. He looked handsome and heroic, fitting snugly once again into his role. His life as a lawyer was behind him, and he had celebrated by appearing in a black shirt beneath his suit and no tie.
Judas Iscariot!
Cried Walter as soon as Robbie had stepped around the corner. The news that he was dying had filled Walter with abandon and rage. Even immediately fronted between Robbie and Wunsch, and Tooley returned from one of his other clients to take hold again of Walter's arm. He was not easily stilled.
Fucking Judas Iscariot! Cried Walter. You're just another loud-mouthed, stinking sellout!
Robbie's wits remained in order.
Right, Walter, he said, and you're the Messiah.
His delivery was perfect, and the acid rain of humiliating laughter drizzled down on Walter, even from a number of his confreres. Despite his condition, malice had revitalized Walter, and it took a considerable effort from Tooley to push Wunsch back down into his seat next to his golf clubs. At the door to the grand jury room, Sennett stood, his hands folded primly.
Mr. Fever, he said with imposing formality. He wanted Robbie to know he was prepared for anything. How are you this morning?
Sick and tired, said Robbie. Especially of you.
Stan didn't flinch. God knows what he thought he deserved. Without a word, he opened the door to the grand jury room and extended a hand to show Robbie in. I told Robbie I would be just outside and reminded him he had the right to stop Sennett at any time to consult me. Robbie smiled generously. He shook my hand and, as he often did, thanked me for everything I'd done before he advanced to the threshold. The sequence of events after that has always remained jumbled. In the ensuing moments, my reactions remained a step behind. I was still attempting to make sense of the first sensation by the time I was hit with the next one. Initially, I heard a sudden crescendo of voices culminating in a drilling female scream. As it turned out, it was Judith, but for some reason I thought it was Even and swung in her direction as something flew past me, stunning the air. A bird was my first impression, a pigeon, some silvery form. I jumped back in panic and at the same time heard a flat sound, vaguely like the noise I knew as a boy when for mean sport we'd smash melons on the hot tar of the road. I realized, though, that something was broken. A small, hard pellet ricocheted off my face, and I was spattered with what I took first for mud. There was an animal smell from somewhere, sudden heat. Then the low, guttural sound that Robbie Favor made as he slumped against me. I caught him, and his completely inert weight pulled me to the floor with him. The back of his suit and the arm I had around him were warmed with what I improbably took first for soup, then realized was blood. There was enormous turmoil now, people yelling for the phone and for doctors, screams from inside the grand jury room, and Walter Wunsch hollering to leave him be as Jim and Even and three or four other persons subdued and disarmed him. In the process, they broke two of his fingers, but they pried from his fist the number two iron whose blade Walter had driven straight through Robbie's skull. I saw the wound then,
which looked wildly out of place, a welling gash, distinct in spite of the gobs of thickened blood that already matted Robbie's crown. Somehow it resembled an open mouth, almost that wide, with red matter that might have been skin crushed inward, and a single protrusion, white and ghastly, which I knew was a piece of Robbie's cranium. I had no idea what to do. For the moment, everything in the universe seemed open to doubt. Realizing there was absolutely no point to it, I applied my handkerchief to the wound, watching the spreading bloodstain creep over the cloth. Even had reached us by then, and I told her quietly what I'd sensed from the first instant he'd fallen against me. I was afraid Robbie was dead. Even grabbed his wrist for a pulse, then tried his neck, and finally brought her face to his lips to feel for breath.
"Turn him over!" she screamed.
Several of us helped her. She pounded his chest 3 times, then she grabbed his nose, from which a thick line of blood had already emerged, and after a tremendous inhalation, applied her mouth to his. She went on with this for at least a minute as every person in the room, even those scurrying about at the periphery, watched. A phone rang repeatedly, and no one picked it up. A moment later, 2 Secret Service agents with paramedical training bolted in. They'd been summoned by one of the assistant U.S. attorneys who'd gone screaming for help. In another minute, an M.D. who had been testifying down the hall as an expert witness crashed through the door and took over. He placed his fingertips on the carotids, then got on his hands and knees and lifted Robbie's head gently to examine the wound.
"Jesus Christ," he said. "Somebody say it was a golf club? It looks like a hatchet."
The club, brown from the shaft to the toe, was still in McManus's hand. Walter, confronting what he'd done and the phenomenon of death that would soon claim him, sat in the same foam chair. His head looked almost unstrung from his body, leaning against the metal doorframe of the grand jury room. He held his broken hand rigidly in the air. A private security guard had appeared from somewhere and stood over him. The 911 paramedics arrived then. They were wheeling oxygen tanks, and they fastened the mask over Robbie's mouth and strapped him to the cart.
"No, I don't want to pronounce him," the M.D. said.
Even sat on the floor with her back against the wall. Her hand, blood-painted up to the knuckles, was over her mouth, and she stared out unseeing. Sennett, who had run for help, dashed back into the room. When he saw me, he averted his eyes. He addressed McManus and asked him how the hell it could have happened. Jim did not bother to reply. I stood and helped Even to her feet. I realized we should go to the hospital. As we headed out, Mel Tooley, who had dug his hands in his trouser pockets, passed a remark to the man guarding Walter.
"I don't think this is going to do much for his handicap."
Afterwards. Today I sit as a judge of the appellate court. As the stink of scandal spread through the Kendall County courts, the Democratic Farmers and Union Party grew desperate to recruit judicial candidates whose independence was not open to doubt. In another example of life's ability to elude expectations, my role in Petros had come to be widely viewed as an emblem of my fortitude. I was just the person they needed. I was elected to a 10-year term and took the oath of office with my father's Bible in my hand. In all, 6 judges, 9 lawyers, and 12 sheriff's deputies and court clerks were convicted in connection with Project Petros. The ricochet effect that Stan had hoped for from the start, the first cooperator implicating a second who turned on a third, more or less occurred. Skolnick and Jillian Sullivan and a judge who had moved on to the felony division all pled guilty and talked. Sherman Crowthers baffled the government bravely through trial, only to succumb after 2 years in the penitentiary. In his orange jumpsuit, 40 pounds thinner,
and unable to shake the cough left by one of several bouts of pneumonia. Sherm made a sad sight. He barely raised his eyes above the rail on the witness stand as he implicated two of the judges from the felony division to whom he'd passed money years before. He seemed almost humiliated by the sheer collapse of his own bravado. Despite these successes, Stan returned to San Diego. He was following his own advice, having shot at the king and missed. Brendan Toohey was never convicted, nor even implicated in any public testimony. Despite a few murmured cavils, he succeeded old Judge Mumphrey as chief of the Kendall County Superior Court a few months after Robbie was killed, inheriting administrative power over every other judge and courtroom. He retired a little more than a year ago. His home in Palm Beach was big enough to cause him to remark often on his extraordinary success in the bull market. But he died in his first month there as the result of a drunken boating accident in which he crashed headlong into a pier at night. The week after Robbie was killed, Stan Sennett had come to see me. He wanted to know what Robbie had done with the tape. He pleaded for almost an hour. He did not understand how I could allow Robbie's death to remain unpunished, or how I could willfully leave a monster like Toohey at large. Robbie's killing was grisly and inflammatory enough that, with the videotape, Stan might yet have been able to convince a jury to convict Brendan Toohey for conspiracy to murder a federal witness. Whether there was a factual basis to the charge was another matter. It's possible that Toohey, by way of his usual sinister indirection, incited Walter to what he did. But Wunsch, who died at the Federal Penitentiary Hospital in Rochester, Minnesota, long before any case could come to trial, maintained he'd been acting on behalf of no one but himself. McManus, who'd interviewed him several times, told me that to the end Walter remained acid and unrepentant. After lengthy consultations with Stern in his role as attorney for Robbie's executor, Morton Dinnerstein, we turned the cassette over to Judge Winchell. Notified by the court, Mel Tooley appeared for Toohey and, as I'd predicted, prevailed on a motion to suppress the tape. The best truth the law could make of the murky circumstances was that Robbie had never consented to the recording, which was, accordingly, unlawful. Mort has survived the years with his role in all of this untold. But his grief, the most visible of anyone's at the extraordinary double funeral the following Sunday, seemed to break him irreparably. He left both the practice of law and, in time, Kendall County after his younger son, Max, graduated from high school. There were happier trails. McManus finished 25 years with the FBI and moved to San Jose, California. He passed the bar there, and, inspired in part by his experiences in Petros, began trying lawsuits at the age of 52. I hear from mutual acquaintances that juries find his even demeanor soothing. Even remained for several years in Kendall County, testifying in half a dozen of the Petros cases, and eventually becoming supervisor of the surveillance squad. 2 years ago, she moved back to the West with a friend, a woman who couldn't forego a glorious job opportunity. By then, Even and I had revisited the events reported here over many evenings. She never discussed investigative details safeguarded by bureau regulations, but her candor about herself was remarkable, and I've always felt it was offered in some fashion as a memorial to Robbie. Despite her willingness to reprise remarkably intimate matters with me, Even has never shared precisely what occurred after we left the hospital the day Robbie was murdered. Yet I've imagined it in the same detail as so much else I've described, but never witnessed. Those were probably the most disoriented hours of my life. I felt as if nature had been reversed, as if my lungs and heart and nerves hung outside my body.
What had happened was not unimaginable, but in fact something that seemed confined only to the realm of the imaginary. Confronting it, I lost all sense of boundaries. But Evan, who'd always experienced a special clarity in urgent moments, was sure about the tasks at hand. She must have returned to Robbie's, since for the time being she had no other place to stay, and showered very quickly before she dismissed Elba, so she could speak to Rainey alone. She applied the laser mount over Rainey's eye in order to allow Lorraine to operate the voice synthesizer, but Rainey, with no small effort, requested it be removed. With the pace of her breathing, she could not focus or move the cursor reliably, and she preferred to see who was talking to her. In the Favors' bedroom, there was a mortar and pestle used to grind up Rainey's medication so they could be ingested. And in plain sight of Lorraine, Evan retrieved the tablets Robbie had mentioned last night and began pulverizing them. She chatted to Rainey all the while, telling her several endearing stories about Robbie, the way he joshed with Leo, his blind cousin, in the courthouse, or cried when he first met his clients. "Quite a boy," she told Rainey. "Quite a boy." She mixed the powder in water, as Robbie'd said he'd do, and then, after using an alligator clip to clamp the line to the feeding tube in Rainey's stomach, Evan poured the solution into the clear plastic bag on top of the IV stand. "Now, Rainey," she went on, "you see what I'm fixing here, and you might wonder why it's me, but in the end, it turns out Robbie can't do this himself. You have to forgive him. You've forgiven him a lot of things in this life, and you'll have to forgive him this one, too. There's a whole lot of weakness in the man. You just can't get around that. You have to take the hide with the fur. But that's the fella. And he is just never going to be able to do this, Rainey. Not this part. That's the bald, unchanging truth. So I'm here. Rather not be, naturally. But I'm here. And I'm easy with it. You know how it is with him, Lorraine. Sometimes you're even glad to be able to do what he needs. But once you get on your way, he'll be right here with you. I promise you that. He's going to come right in and take hold of your hand as you're falling asleep. He's going to be telling 100 funny stories about some of the great things you've done together and saying a few prayers. You're going to feel him right with you, right here." Evan directed herself to Rainey's remarkable amethyst-colored eyes, where her soul still shone unimpaired. She felt Robbie himself could not have lied more convincingly. Indeed, she felt, as he'd feel, that she was not lying at all. Evan had pulled up a chair beside the bed and stroked Rainey's hand, bruised from the injections and infiltrating IVs, the muscles so wasted they felt almost liquid within the skin. She went on with what she had to say, as Lorraine struggled for breath under the fogged plastic of the oxygen mask. "Now this, me being here and everything, this may be a little quick. And if it is, I can come back tomorrow, or the day after, or whenever, or never. Because maybe right now, as you face it, I guess, maybe you might very well feel that, after all, this isn't what you want to do. Everybody will still be here for you. We'll have that dock here. We'll have that vent going in no time at all. Now, if you're ready, then I'm here with you. And if you're not, that's just fine. I'm here with you too. But I need you to tell me. If you're ready, if this is what you want, then you have to tell me. I'm going to count to three. And after I get to three, I want you to blink your eyes very slowly if you want this to go ahead. If this is your time, squeeze 'em shut for a three count. You know, 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000. And then open them again. And that means for me to go on. Unless you do that, Nothing's going to happen except me getting Elba in here to set up a new IV. But otherwise, you have to blink. Blink to say this is what you want. All right? You ready now? I'm going to start.
She blinked.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Personal Injuries, written by Scott Turow, read by Mark Bramhall.
Executive Producer, Michelle McGonigal.
Producer, John McElroy. Elgin Productions, Inc. Directed by Zach Harries. Recorded by Mosaic Audio. Post-production by Elgin Productions, Inc. Personal Injuries is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 1990 by Scott Turow. Audio production copyright 2014, Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.